Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am a TV critic who covers Game of Thrones and other shows for such publications as Rolling Stone, Vulture, and the New York Observer. I am the co-author of the official annotated Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org in the World of Ice and Fire, and series editor Anne Grohl. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled, and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones weblog located at BoiledLeather.com, which is the humble host for this podcast. And with me, as always, is my not-so-humble, extremely illustrious co-host.
Stefan Sasse, I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And before we start today, I guess we'll make a quick update on what we've been up to in these last past weeks, and I pass back to Sean right away.
Yeah, as you'll see when we introduce the topic for this episode, this is actually not just a sales pitch, it's actually directly relevant to what we'll be talking about today. But as we've mentioned over the last couple of episodes, the Boiled Leather Audio Hour is now up on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour, you can become a patron of the show and donate an amount of your choice per month as sort of a voluntary subscription service. The show will always be free, but the more money we make, the easier it will be for us to carve time out of our working schedules to make the podcast. We've already sworn by Ice and Fire to record 12 episodes a year at the very least. That's one episode a month because we hit a certain pledge threshold on the Patreon. So thank you everybody for that. There's all kinds of cool rewards you can get. You can be part of a question and answer episode here on the show. You can help determine future episodes, you know, what the topics are. There's, I think, a print by my partner, Julia Gaffer, of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour Wolf's Head logo that's available. We've listed our goals so that you can see what, as we get to different amounts per month, what that will kind of get you guys in return. Looks like we just passed the 300 a month threshold. We're closing in, hopefully, on 400, at which point we're going to look very seriously into improving the recording software, which I know very, very many of you will be quite excited to hear. And, you know, it's a pretty cool system. So, you know, please feel free to check it out. I guess I should also mention that if you go to BoiledLeather.com, the emergency PayPal donation button to help offset the cost of fixing my broken laptop is still up there. You're still welcome to give. You know, every penny that I've gotten through that has been extremely vitally useful. So thank you very much. And again, patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour is the way to become a patron. So without further ado, like I said, this isn't just a sales pitch. It's actually very relevant because at the threshold pledge of $50 a month, you alone, person who pledges $50 a month in this podcast, can decide the topic of an entire episode by yourself. And some wonderful person actually did it. And we were convinced it was a mistake. But no, they were really serious. So that's what our topic will be today. And I'll leave it to Stefan to tell us more about it.
Yeah, so we are obviously very excited about this because when we created this $50 reward where you can set your own topic for the next Boiled Leather Audio Hour, we didn't really seriously think that anyone would do this. I mean, we are overly happy, of course, that someone did, but we didn't expect it in any capacity. So we are really excited to do this today. And the topic that was actually is coming out of this pledge was put in by Rosie Gleason. And she asked us to talk a little bit about a peculiar edge to the Blackfyre Rebellion. Because what she's asking, what we should try to analyze today, is the the fallout that the Blackfyre Rebellion has on the treatment of bastards in the original timeline, you know, when in that time of Westerosi history when the books are out. And she has basically asked the question, would Caitlin be a little bit more friendly towards Jon Snow? Would Cersei be a little less paranoid towards Robert's bastards and so on? If the Blackfyre Rebellion hadn't happened, which is quite an interesting idea. And just to get you up to speed, Blackfyre Rebellion, of course, is this big historic event in the history of Westeros, where a Targaryen bastard who was legitimized by the Bad King Aegon the Fourth started a rebellion in order to gain the Iron Throne, and was in a very close run thing put down, and there were several rebellions afterwards. So it was a really big deal. And we think this is really an interesting question. It's a little bit specific, so please bear with us. But I guess we will be able to make some general points here about bastards as well, and of course of the general impact and fallout of an event as shattering and generation embracing as the Blackfyre Rebellion. So I guess we will start with a enhanced focus on the narrative structure.
Right, because I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yes, but please go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the main thrust of her question wound up being, would we have seen the behavior of various characters towards bastards differently had we learned more about the very existence of the Blackfyre Rebellions, let alone the level of detail that we've since gained earlier in the narrative, because it is a kind of thing that's sort of pushed to the side entirely for the whole first book. Stefan, I think you mentioned it was first introduced in A Clash of Kings.
If I'm not totally mistaken, it was mentioned in A Clash of Kings and more explored in more detail in A Storm of Swords and, of course, the second and third Duncan Egg story.
Right, and it becomes such a huge deal in Duncan Egg in the ancillary materials like the World of Ice and Fire. And then, of course, it becomes a sort of major present plotline with, you know, young Griff in Book five. So, and presumably it's the kind of thing that exerts a very, very heavy influence on the day-to-day lives of any characters who are in a position where they're able to think historically. So it touches on a lot of things culturally within the world, and then the shape and impact of various events in the narrative to us as readers. So it's an interesting. For something so specific, as Stefan put it, there's actually a pretty wide range of stuff we can touch on here.
Yes, and I guess we really should start appreciating that the whole Blackfyre Rebellion thing is in a certain kind of sense retconned into the narrative, because at the moment of the writing of A Game of Thrones and The Hedge Knight, the first Duncan Egg story, the Blackfyre Rebellion basically didn't exist. So, for example, these important scenes about bastards, where they are established and where we first meet all those prejudices, like in the infamous Catelyn scene where she tells Jon Snow it should be him lying there and all that kind of stuff. The Blackfyre Rebellion didn't exist in the narrative back then. So if we look at these scenes today, it is difficult to discern and to differentiate between the knowledge that we now have about such an event and the knowledge that was available to readers when the books came out. So this is a little bit difficult, and I guess you can make a long argument about whether or not Martin has intended from the get-go to get them in, including Aegon and all that kind of stuff, or if he didn't. But I guess we don't want to dig too deep in this, because there is quite a lot of speculation involved here, and I'm quite frankly not feeling fluent enough in the matter to do this on the level it deserves.
It does seem like one of those Tolkienian situations where the tale grew in the telling, to use his phrase. You know, and that's when you're dealing with stories like this. I mean, for crying out loud, in the first edition of The Hobbit, Bilbo really did win the ring, you know, and the ring wound up being what the entire story, or larger story, was about. So Tolkien actually went back and rewrote that portion for subsequent editions. And, you know, Stephen King has done this to a much more deleterious effect with the Dark Tower series. So, you know, I think that, you know, from a meta perspective, like Stefan said, the reason we don't hear more about the Blackfyre Rebellion earlier in the series is because, for all intents and purposes, it didn't exist yet. But here's the thing. I also think that there is an artistic and narrative justification for not introducing it too heavily at that moment anyway, which is particularly for the first volume. The event from the past, the civil war from the past, that has to factor most strongly in everything. It's got to be Robert's Rebellion. Anything else would be a distraction, because that's the whole story at that point. Robert's Rebellion and the fallout from Robert's Rebellion and what happened and who did it and the continued fallout today. So if they had, you know, obviously, there was the Greyjoy Rebellion subsequent to that. If they had introduced yet another series of civil wars, you know, in more than passing, it would have, I think, overwhelmed the need to keep that narrative real tight at first. Because we often forget, I think, how focused the first book, A Game of Thrones, really is. It's a murder mystery, you know. It's got all this, like, intriguing world building going on. But the sprawl doesn't begin for quite some time. You know, at first it's quite focused. And to have introduced the Blackfyre Rebellions at that point, let's say Martin did have the idea, I still think it would have been wise for him to hold his fire, because, no pun intended, because otherwise you lose the tight focus on Stark and Lannister and Baratheon that you really, really needed to have at that time, and Targaryen.
Yes, we should also keep in mind that the story about young Griff or Aegon especially starts off as a Lannister backstory, which is, if memory serves correctly, again, so please fact check us and correct us if we're wrong. But it is introduced in A Clash of Kings in form of this small discussion on the side about the fate of Aegon, the son of Rhaegar, you know, him being presumably killed by smashing his head against the wall, and then Martin's cryptic comment back then when he was still answering fan emails in a larger capacity about Rhaenys is definitely dead. I will make no such comment on Aegon, and everyone was like, what? So it seems like he did begin to plan that stuff back then. So it basically started as a Lannister backstory, and we don't get that much of Lannister backstory in Game of Thrones, which is very much focused on the Stark family and, of course, on Tyrion, but Tyrion is not really a Lannister, so that doesn't count here, I guess. So the point you are making about Game of Thrones being more focused, I can only underscore that here. And there is also another narrative consideration to make, because if we get knowledge like the complete backstory of the Blackfyre Rebellion, besides the thing being really exposition heavy, which arguably weighs down the Sword and Sword as well, we also get a new prism through which we see and judge everything that is going on, and it really distracts us from the narrative that A Game of Thrones wants to tell us, and even A Clash of Kings, because all those shadows from the past cannot really play any larger role in these first two or three books, because they have a really fast-paced plot going on. And controversially, on the other side, with the middle act of The Feast for Crows and The Dance with Dragons, it makes quite a lot of sense for this backstory to come back with a vengeance in this book, because the shadows of the past are everywhere, from Tywin's death to Eddard and all those things in the north, you know, like with Lady Barbara and yada yada. There is so much going on with the younger generation discovering what happened in their father's or grandfather's generation that still influences them, and it really fits in very well. But the first three books, as you said, are defined by Robert's Rebellion, so this makes quite a lot of sense. And now to pivot into this question of, does it change how bastards are treated? I guess not, actually, because as far as I understand it, this treatment of bastards is pretty universal, and bastards pose a threat to your inheritance and to stability regardless. And then you have all those cultural prejudices, like they are born of lust and of sin, and so they are also lustful and sinful and can't be trusted. If you look at how Westerosi are viewing women or how Westerosi are viewing foreigners, their treatment of bastards fits right in. Now I have it, regardless of Blackfyre Rebellion or not.
I agree, and you know, Rosie had asked, you know, one of her sub questions in her message to us. You know, was like, for example, would we have thought differently about the massacre of Robert's bastards? You know, following his death, had we known about the Blackfyre Rebellion? I don't think so. You know, I mean, if you watch, like we always say, the show is not the books, but if you watch the books, if you watch the show, I don't think that you needed a whole big dollop of Blackfyre backstory to understand why Joffrey and Cersei would be paranoid about other people, with Robert's, bloodline flowing through their veins, running around out there. You know, you just need to say bastards are a threat to the legitimate heirs. You know, people can rally around them, and we need to get rid of them. And particularly in the case of Robert's bastards, there was the additional hiding the evidence element, where they were trying to get rid of all these people because they had dark hair, unlike all of his supposedly legitimate children. So that's just one example where, yeah, I don't think you need a whole huge, you know, fall of the Galactic Senate kind of story to make the treatment of bastards in Westeros comprehensible. I think it's pretty clear from the start, for all kinds of reasons, for social prejudice and just general benightedness, like Stefan said, to, you know, you just with a few broad strokes, you can pretty clearly convey the political threat that bastards can represent to legitimate heirs. So
it is also somehow a very uncomfortable line of thinking, you know, like the slaughtering of children suddenly becomes acceptable because there is historic precedent that they might become dangerous in the future. This is an evil act, and I think Martin is pretty unambiguous about that. You simply cannot murder children. You know, this is an evil thing to do. And if you are introducing the narrative earlier, like if he would have introduced it in the Game of Thrones, and in a way that people could use it to apologize the murders of all those bastards and the treatment of bastards, it would really divert from what this is really about, because this is about the whole story is basically about characters and how they are interacting with each other. That has always been the focus of it, and you always run into danger when you are presenting more and more lore and heap on it. You're always going into this danger zone where you are analyzing the text not from those perspectives of theme and narrative structure and all that kind of stuff, but where you are going on little details and are suddenly introducing thoughts that are not exactly what the author was really telling you, but that get lost in the noise of all that background information. You know, it is like this endless discussion about whether or not Tywin is an effective ruler when he kills and slaughters people. You know how I hate this argument, right? But this is basically going in the same direction. You know, you are getting more and more of this discussion if you go down this road. Or is Bryn and Tully justified in expelling the small folk to a certain death in the eye of also certain defeat at the end of Storm of Swords, and so on and so forth. And if we don't really need to add the discussion about is Cersei justified to kill about 15 children in King's Landing from the ages of 0 to 3 or whatever? This is not what Martin's books are about. I'm pretty confident to say that. So that might be another reason why it's kept out here.
Yeah, I mean, some stuff is useful to understanding cultural context, but as we've argued from the very, very first episode we ever did, you're not meant to look at A Song of Ice and Fire solely within the cultural context of the books. They weren't written in this imaginary world, in this imaginary time, by one of these imaginary people. They were written in America in the late 20th and early 21st century by a left-wing American fantasy writer. And that's how you're supposed to understand them. So, yeah, there's a degree to which if you get too bogged down in the cultural justifications within the story, you can lose sight of what's actually being conveyed. But I wanted to get back to something you said earlier, which is how well the introduction of Blackfyre stuff in a larger way works when it actually does happen in this sort of middle volume, the feast dance zone. And this is something we've talked about, and it's been a favorite topic of mine when discussing these books, particularly Dance, which is that there's definitely an everything you know is wrong theme going on in these books, where you're suddenly reevaluating things as fundamental as time, like just how long things have been going on, how old this place is. You're getting all this new information about the previously largely benign worship of the old gods, you know, turns out to be a blood cult like anything else was, you know, and so on and so on. We could go, you know, there's the Maester conspiracy idea, all this kind of stuff that we had always just taken for granted is now being called into question. So here's where it makes sense for the sort of mainline introduction of a whole other set of rebellions and a whole other conflict between, you know, a king who's perceived unworthy and you know, like a macho man who people liked. And it also serves as a bridge in that sense to the information that we're getting from the world book and from the novellas about the, you know, the history of the Targaryens. You know, where basically the entire history of Westeros since the Targaryen takeover has, like, maybe one out of three monarchs was involved in some sort of massive civil war, right? Like, there was the fight against the Faith Militant, there was the Blacks and the Greens, there was, like, all 20 Blackfyre rebellions. There were so goddamn many of them. There was Robert's Rebellion, there was the Greyjoy Rebellion, there's the War of the Five Kings, you know, so while it wouldn't make sense up front to contextualize Robert's Rebellion as just one of many civil wars, it needs to be special, like I was kind of alluding to earlier. At this point in the story, where you're starting to get all this information that calls into question so many fundamental precepts of how you understand this world, that's when it makes sense to introduce the idea that, like, these motherfuckers have always been fighting each other, you know? There's always been people with legitimate beefs and illegitimate beefs. Again, no pun intended with the bastard stuff and illegitimacy. You know, there's always been people who think they have the claim to the throne and always people who think they don't. And it always gets gussied up in this, like, highfalutin moral language. But bottom line, it's just who has more swords and more dragons and better spears and, you know, a sorcerer or whoever, you know, or whatever the case may be. That's when it makes sense to introduce that stuff. Not at first, but, you know, when the entire wider scaffolding of the world building is suddenly shaky.
I also want to emphasize that most of the information about the Blackfyre Rebellion that we have comes from the companion books, you know, the second and third Duncan Egg story, and of course the World of Ice and Fire. So if Martin meant for this historic event to take such an predominant role in explaining certain behaviors of characters that that goes back into the first book, then he would have introduced it in the main narrative in a more important function,
yes.
like he did Robert's Rebellion, because that's important for our main characters, right? And as you said, this is mainly important as a backdrop to the Game of Thrones has always been played. This is a major theme of yours that you're touching all the time, especially when it comes to the Essos plot. You know, when people are asking, why do we spend so much time in Essos? You always said, and this is quite on point, I think, that it shows you that the Game of Thrones is not a Westeros exclusive game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true, of course, in history. And the Targaryen age has from the start been presented to us as a more or less golden age until Aerys comes in power and he fucks it all up. And when we start to delve deeper into that history and to actually read up on it, we really get into, no, that's not true. You know, there has always been light, there has always been dark, there have been better periods, there have been worse periods. And I think we are also in for a major surprise sometime later when we see how the later reign of Aegon V will go. But because that can't be just all good, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this has been a trademark of Martin's. And this is really how you have to see the Blackfyre Rebellion. It does distract you a little bit from the main narrative, which is, I guess, why he did mostly outsource it into his companion works, like The Dance of the Dragons as well. It is very useful to contextualize what is happening in the main narrative. So if you are going really deep, like rereading it at least once a year, and you know really what's going on, then it is very good to know, and it helps you a lot to understand all that kind of stuff. But if you are only reading the story and only want to get a grasp on what is happening and to understand those characters, you don't need the Blackfyre Rebellion, really. It is just a throwaway comment then, basically, that this happened once. And then that's okay. That's all the major impact it has on the big storyline, at least until we know what's the deal about Aegon and Varys and all that kind of stuff. But for the first three books, at least, it doesn't play a major role. It is nice to know, but you don't need to.
Right. Yeah. Aegon is obviously the great exception. And if it turns out that it's not just Aegon's Blackfyre lineage, I think. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, if it turns out that Varys is a Blackfyre, like, is a Blackfyre, and not just supporting a Blackfyre claimant to make his play for ruling Westeros from behind the scenes as sort of an enlightened monarch or whatever his ultimate scheme is, then it'll be an even bigger deal, because Varys is a much bigger deal than young Griff / Aegon himself is. But again, that's still kind of an exception. And I agree, you know, that there's a reason that the stuff is being deployed in ancillary materials and not in the main narrative. It's because it's not really part of the main narrative. It's interesting, but it's not necessary. So to get back to the question of, you know, would it shape our views of characters who reacted to Bastards in a certain way? Like, I guess, but it's not really necessary. Because it's a side story, an interesting side story, and one with some potential impact on the main story, through Aegon, but, and Varys, but a side story nonetheless.
Yeah. I also want to point out that if you look at the show, they have no problem of introducing all those concepts of bastardy and how people react to it, and to make it understandable and the motives clear without ever once talking about the Blackfyre Rebellion, right? You get from the get-go what the position of bastards is in this society. And you do this without actually needing this historical context. And I'm also not quite sold on the Blackfyre Rebellion at the time of the Game of Thrones is still looming that large in the heads of people. Because earth-shattering historical events have a tendency to supplant each other.
True.
So, for example, the memory of World War I was transplanted by the memory of World War II, and it is the same in Westeros. I see the whole story about the Blackfyre Rebellion and how it influences a younger generation that has not actually lived through it is more a mirror of what happens for our young heroes in a Game of Thrones with Robert's Rebellion than it is a necessary requisite to understand it. You know, it's a story that rhymes. Because if you look at Aegon V, Egg, or Dunk, neither of them has any personal recollection of the Blackfyre Rebellion, but their lives are totally shaped by it. And Jon and Rob, their lives are totally, or Tyrion, are totally shaped by it without them actually living through it. I mean, Tyrion was alive, obviously, but he didn't really experience it. He's too young. And this is the more important aspect about it. And the more you progress in the narrative, the more in the main story, The Song of Ice and Fire, Robert's Rebellion is slowly pushing into the forefront. You know, think of A Dance with Dragons, where Theon discovers how much all those hatreds and old grudges and feuds and all that kind of stuff that is has been started by people who are long dead now. I mean, Barbara Dustin is the prime example for this, with her Brandon, he fucked me once, so now, sorry, and now I'm basically trying to take revenge 20 years later on his younger brother, who has been dead 2 years now by denying his bones access to the North. There you can see how history is influencing people. And you can see the same thing in The Mystery Knight, where Duncan Egg or the young Glendon Ball are caught up in events that they have no business in shaping, but that are influencing them regardless. So I think this mirroring aspect is much more important.
Yeah, and that's probably the best way to understand so much of what goes on. You touched on it earlier when you mentioned my very frequently made point that the point of the Essos material is to show that the Game of Thrones plays out all over the world in all kinds of cultures. It's just as important to the people there as the quest for the Iron Throne is to the people in Westeros. You know, it's meant to show the universality of these themes. And I think that the same is true of the Blackfyre Rebellion or the Dance of the Dragons or, you know, any real other historical conflict. It's not that it has a pressing weight on the characters that we know. It's that, you know, it's just meant to show that the flow of history, you know, kind of winds up in the same tidal pools and eddies over and over and over again. Which I think is an interesting point. Because the temptation is always to make the era that you're living through exceptional.
Yes.
And it's not, you know, which cuts both ways. It makes you reconsider how good and how bad things are right now, and it makes you reconsider how good and how bad things were in the historical eras that you picture in the past. You know, like I think, and in the cultures involved. You know, I think a big part of American politics right now on the left is, you know, kind of taking the sophomore year in college, like, wow, man, America's always been fucked up, you know, realization that we all have, and then just sort of trying to make like a working adult politics out of that, like, you know, having been taught from birth about American exceptionalism. As it happens, America's really not that exceptional, you know. In all kinds of respects, we've done all the shitty things that every other country has done. So where do you go from there? And I think that's the Song of Ice and Fire's project in a way, is it's you have this heroic narrative about Robert's Rebellion and Ned Stark and all these things and the Targaryens, and then as you learn more about history, you start to peel away the layers of the heroic, you know, exceptional narrative and see what's really going on, see what's really animating human behavior and historical processes and stuff. And that's the real function of the Blackfyre Rebellion, not to impact individual decisions, but to serve sort of a larger point about the nature of power and politics and violence in this world that he's writing about.
One important point about the Blackfyre Rebellion that I've made at length in one of my essays is that it is also very strongly about the question of legitimacy. You know, what ideals the Westerosi society holds up. Because what you have in this whole Blackfyre Rebellion story, at least for the first Blackfyre Rebellion, is this conflict between Daeron II, on the one hand, who is round-bellied and not fit, and he surrounds himself with maesters and singers and intellectual elites and with these Dornish foreigners who should be kept out of Westeros by a wall, a big, huge, beautiful one. And on the other hand, you have this this real tough guy, this daemon who has been given the mighty magic sword, and he is fit and he looks every inch a king, and he is summoning all those heroes around himself, and he's not a learned man, you know, he's a doer. He won't ask questions, he will simply do it, and all that kind of stuff. And the fight between those two ideologies is something that we also see again in A Song of Ice and Fire. For example, it is introduced to us in the second John chapter when they are on their way to the wall, when John asks Tyrion why he reads so much. You know, this has an undertone of, why are you reading? You know, this is a weakling's kind of pastime, and only idiots read. The real men are going out in sword fight. And Tyrion is teaching him the value of books, a lesson Sam will later take up. So these are conflicting worldviews, and our sympathies are not really lying with those guys who idolize the flat stomach and the strong sword arm, right? So these narratives that are clashing here produce an interesting backdrop to this story, and a lens through which you can read the narrative, and which I would argue also helps you to understand our own world. Because our politicians and our political campaigns are also riffing on these topics. Of course, not with the muscles anymore and the swords, but this contest of machismo and who has the strongest military and who will throw the most bombs and all that kind of stuff. It's still there, you know. These are timeless things. And I would put much more emphasis on the themes that the story of the Blackfyre Rebellion is emphasizing rather than the events themselves.
Sounds fair to me. we're so on the same page here, man.
Yeah, that's a new one. Sometimes I fear we are really boring with this, but I really hope that our audience is keeping with us regardless. I mean, I really find the Blackfyre Rebellion very fascinating, please don't get me wrong. And I love to delve into the details of all of it. And for example, you really can't understand the Duncan Egg stories if you haven't, if you don't have a firm grasp on the Blackfyre Rebellion story, you will lose so much context. And this is more true than Robert's Rebellion is for the Song of Ice and Fire story, for example. Yeah. So this is definitely something that is also dear to me. So I don't want to diminish or belittle it in any way. But I think you are reading it wrong if you think it as a lens through which you will better understand the actions of characters, because those you get by looking at who they are really and how they act and what beliefs they hold. And this isn't all revolving around one particular historical event.
Yeah, I would agree. One last point I would make is that just for fun, you can look at the Blackfyre Rebellion as an analog to the American Civil War. You know, with the sort of myth of the lost cause and you know, these noble, you know, war, you know, the you could probably swap out proper nouns and find things written today about Robert E. Lee that are written about Fireball and Bittersteel in the books, you know. And you know, all you have to do is sort of replace each subsequent Blackfyre Rebellion with, you know, the end of Reconstruction or the erection of Jim Crow or, you know, the Dixiecrats and, like, you know, and the Blackfyre partisans in A Song of Ice and Fire's world, you know, just kept mounting unsuccessful rebellions. You know, the partisans of the South and the Civil War, American Civil War, just found new ways to fuck black people. But it's the same basic, you know, principle. You know, there is the split and people cannot let it go and, you know, continuously try to achieve their aims through other means. And just as a as a kind of historical footnote, I guess. That's an interesting way to look at it. But again, it's like Stefan said, it's a thematic concern, more than it's a concern that impacts directly upon the behavior of individual characters.
That sounds like a fitting endpoint.
I agree. Well, this was fun. I hope more people pitch in $50 a month, not just because I want to be getting more people pitching in $50 a month, but because I don't think we would have come up with this topic on our own in quite these terms, and it wound up being really interesting. You know, but whatever you choose to donate, if you choose to donate, if you go to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour, your support means a great deal. It really, I think already has paid dividends in our ability to keep the show, running on a more frequent schedule and getting direct feedback from the listeners. You know, much to Stefan's chagrin, I think I do an incredibly poor job of keeping track of who listens to the show, how many people listen to it. I have no idea. I don't even know how to have any idea, because it was set up just so casually. So in a way, the feedback that we've gotten from patrons has been our most direct line yet on what people are interested in. But wherever you choose to comment, like whether or not you donate and leave us a note or pitch in an idea or something, you know, we love hearing you from you on Twitter or at boiledleather.com or Tower of the Hand or Nerdstream Era in the comments. So, you know, it's just nice to, your feedback has meant a lot to us, at least as much as your money has meant to us. Although the money means a lot.
Yeah, well, obviously it does. So, thanks again for Rosie Gleason from Dublin to patronize us, Patreon us.
I guess
there has,
so.
There has to be a word for it,
right?
But really, thank you. It has been quite a blast, and we will hold a poll in the very near future among our eligible Patreon. So, if you chime in with $5 or more, you get to vote on one topic that we will cover. So, at least you get a little bit of this great $50 experience here. So, there's still time for one of 2 or 3 days until we close that and start our very first poll. So, yeah, take it as your chance.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Thank you, Rosie, in particular. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will see you next time.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.